You are listening to A Good Book on Sun Sounds of Arizona.
Kirin's The Spell of Noan, written and narrated by James D. Priest.
He awoke with a start, unsure how long he had been sleeping.
"It's impossible to tell time here," he grumbled, swinging his long feet over the edge of the bed and standing up.
He woke Hutt, and they climbed to the Farrenen, where they found, to their disappointment, no change in Tally.
"No word of your woman has come," said Lenara, still sitting on the stool, appearing not to have moved a muscle.
The lieutenant hurried in and made a long-awaited report, and the queen translated for the anxious visitors.
"We have not found your woman."
She paused, then went on sternly in her reedy voice.
"I have come to a difficult decision. We have searched far and wide, some places familiar, some not. But enough is enough. With the exception of sentries, I am bringing my tribesmen home."
She turned and rasped new orders. The officer departed. Spekeren was shocked. "The Shillitoes," he thought, "are giving up. Hutt, we must take our Eilon and find her ourselves." He knew, of course, there were underground passageways, but had no idea of their vastness and complexity, and no knowledge of anything living in them. And little did he know that because the tunnels were occupied, the queen's judgment was being affected.
"You'll do no such thing," she declared.
"Why not?"
"No one will lead you or search for you when you're lost."
"Look," said Hutt, nodding toward Tally. The old magician knelt next to her. Stirring, she was shifting in position and seemed to be struggling. Spekeren and Hutt stayed by her side, speaking quiet words, telling her she was safe, their happiness at seeing her come to life tempered by their anxiety about Deliani. After a long period of restlessness, Tally became still, then slowly opened her eyes, blinked, and glanced about as if trying to see where she was. Her gaze falling upon Spekeren, she reached out and touched his sleeve, then put her hand to her right eye and massaged it gently. With vacant eyes staring ahead, she spoke, and her speech was formal and unemotional.
"I have been far away, and at first knew something grave had happened, but not what. I was in a place I had never been, and sensed I was doomed, destined to remain there forever. For a long while I wandered through a dim twilight and thought I was alone, and I was cold and forlorn. Gradually I realized I was among other Kirins, and somehow knew they were our ancestors. But they were shrouded in dark, hooded garments, and I could not see their faces. I encountered shadows, flashes of white light, and cloaked images, trying many times to communicate with them, always to no avail."
Spekeren suddenly understood why her speech was formal and was even more relieved she was back. Affected by the ancestors, she had come home from the ancestral fields. She had returned from the dead.
"Tally," he said gently, "you're weak. You needn't go on. Gain strength before you tell the rest."
"I must go on," said the blonde girl, blinking and gazing at him. "Then the ancestors, now in great numbers, began milling and congregating around something, some attraction, I knew not what. At the edge of the milling crowd, I was weakening, my eris failing. I urgently needed help, or I would expire, and asked those near me for aid, but they ignored me as though I weren't there. For an eternity, I wandered at the edge of the multitude, but finally, in my solitude and resignation, one turned to me, and I saw a face. It was kind and pleading, and without a word he motioned me toward him, and I went. He turned and blended in with the crowd, but I kept moving forward, the throng parting before me. I proceeded for a great distance through the gathering, a sea of ancient Kirins,
none looking at me as I progressed toward a destination they were all facing, a place they were indicating, without a word being spoken, I must go to. Finally, she said more animatedly, I saw something at the center of the immense crowd, all of them gazing at it, and I slowly approached it, a pedestal, darkly hued, perhaps black. On its flat upper surface burned a small flame, barely flickering, giving off so little light it illuminated even the closest of the ancestors only meagerly. Then I knew what it was. My Eris, my own Eris, in its final decline, its passing being observed by a host of ancestors, perhaps all our ancestors. I had been called to witness it myself, thus witnessing my own passing. But without them uttering a word, I was made aware of something vital. I would be welcomed cordially and comfortably into their midst, and not be lonely or distressed. My transformation from living Kirin into one of them would be painless and smooth. All of us stood, watching and waiting, as the flame diminished until it was barely visible, and finally went out. A glowing cinder remained, and its glint became fainter, thin smoke trailing upward. Soon the spark would be extinguished, and my life would be over. Thinking of my family, Jilin, our traveling party, my friends at home, I dearly wished to see everyone before dying and joining these ancestors. They would welcome me, but I was still afraid. She touched her right eye. Then, as quick as a flash, something happened. I felt an irritation, a burning in my eye, and the smoking cinder, its glow barely perceptible, burst into a small golden flame that expanded rapidly. When I turned to the ancestors, they were gone, every one of the vast multitude, and I stood alone by the burgeoning blaze. I sensed something new, being drawn upward by an unseen force, lifted above and away from the fire. I watched it from on high, growing, blazing, and flourishing, but it receded ever farther into the distance as upward and upward I went until it disappeared in a distant flash. I had moved far and was in total darkness, but continued to ascend for a very long time, gradually sensing light, as if within a dim haze or faintly illuminated cloud, which became brighter and brighter. Finally I heard sounds, of voices it seemed, and I was elated. I hoped I was coming back to life or going home and might see Jilin. Joyfully remembering my Eris burning strongly far below, I could begin to see outlines of a space. She glanced about. This space! And I could feel I was coming alive. And, she said, raising her head off the pillow and grasping Spekeren's arm, it seems I have. You have indeed, said the magician, celebrating her return and the incredible account of her journey. Seeing your own Eris, it's most amazing. He turned happily to the old queen. She's been to the ancestral fields, a place few Kirins have come back from. Lenara was visibly moved, her usually pallid cheeks almost rosy. I've never known it to happen. Spekeren turned to Tali. You've witnessed what occurs when our Eris burns out. We are taken in, united with our predecessors, nurtured as part of the whole, as we and all future Kirins will be. But we're exceedingly glad you returned, and don't want you to go there again soon. He glanced at the beaming faces around Tali in the Farinum. It was a joyous occasion indeed. But his pleasure was all at once blunted, and he frowned, because Deliani wasn't among them. Chapter 46. Entering the dazzling space, Deliani's only thought was to go to the healing area and learn about Tali. She had no idea how ragged she looked to those astonished Shillitoes near the entrance and didn't care. Dropping her fading torch, she told Manet to return to her shelter with the other ravens. Moments earlier, the two had experienced an exhilarating reunion. Through different corridors and routes, she and the raven had been led to a meeting point in the dark tunnel leading to the cave by Byros and another unnamed Grigla.
"Cave," said Byros in Ruvan, pointing to a circle of light ahead. "You go."
"Thank you," said Deliani, stroking the relieved raven's neck. "Your people saved us both." After bidding the Griglas farewell, she and Manet had started toward the cave. Now, hands shielding her eyes from its many torches, brighter to her than an unclouded midday sun, she moved haltingly across the floor, then the central bridge, and made it to the far wall. "I now know," she thought, "what the Griglas felt those countless years ago when their sanctuary was invaded with blazing and defiling fire. I am part Grigla, unable to see because of the brilliance, and knowing what one living thing can do to another." Moving through dim passageways on the way to meet Manet, she had, as promised, thought of Silarud. The Kirin had been changed by her encounter with darkness and these mysterious underground people. Later, when she tried to tell what happened, what her saviors were like, and how she felt about them, no one understood what indelible impressions had been made on her. "How different they are," she thought, "avoiding light, having no tolerance for the sun, while those are utter necessities for us. Yet I owe everything to them, for without them I'd still be in the dark." Now, shunning help from nearby Shillitoes for reasons they would never understand, she found the ladder leading up the wall and began a halting climb, moving as fast as her strength allowed. Followed closely all the way by two well-meaning Shillitoes, she finally reached the Farrenen and stood unsteadily on its promontory, gazing at the tribe's enormous cave, now knowing so much more about it. There was the waterfall emerging from the stone fortress that had been her restraint, her prison. She searched for the hole, her only window to the world, but it was too far and too small to see. She looked at the stream meandering through the cave and the bridges, last seeing them through the hole, how long ago she didn't know. She was too drained to sense relief at viewing the setting from a friendly vantage point. Swaying from weakness and hunger, she turned and stumbled into the Farrenen. Sitting up, Tali blinked at her, and for the first time since leaving the cave, Deliani smiled before collapsing on the nearest bed. Some time had elapsed since Deliani's return. The crowd which gathered upon word of it had long since dispersed from the Farrenen. Only Lydor, his attendants, Speckeren, and Hutt remained, caring for the two patients. Speckeren would otherwise have been exhausted, but everything changed when Deliani reappeared and Tali came to life. The magician divided his attention, cheerfully moving between them, examining them, ordering food and drink for them, forgetting he himself was a guest, caring only that his charges were back. "I doubted the Farrenor," he thought, glancing at Lydor, "when he tapped that flask and sent the droplet into Tali's eye. But it turns out he knew what he was doing. I was wrong, and am very glad I was." In the days to follow, both patients recovered, Deliani more readily, her only needs being rest and, as Silarud had suggested, kinnan food, both being granted amply. The red-haired Renegar visited Deliani regularly, bringing fruits and flowers he gleaned outside the cave. He told her how devastating it had been while she was lost, and about his sessions with the old queen, teaching him to extend the powers of his voice. He was a Shillito, and Deliani now felt differently about them, but Runagar intrigued her. When he told her how much he wished to join the quest, she wanted to be optimistic and wondered whether it might actually happen. Tally's recuperation was slow. So close to extinction had her heiress been, and she so close to death. Shortly after awakening, she asked about Jilin and was told he had not been heard from. Taking his blue gemstone from her belt satchel, she held it in her hand, where it stayed most of her waking hours in the Farinan. Spekeren asked Deliani where she had been and what prompted her to leave in the first place. She answered superficially, saying she was too fatigued to talk about it. Before telling the whole story, even to her magician, she was determined to speak privately with Lanara.
"This will be a mission of greater hazard," said Spekeren, "but hopefully greater benefit than you or your son can imagine."
"We know little about it," said Binarin, Runagar's father, "except what our queen has said. It is vitally important to all Kirans, and our son deeply wishes to be part of it."
"What we've learned about him," said Rana, Runagar's mother, "makes us proud indeed, and is changing our beliefs about birds."
They were attending an evening meeting in the throne room, special torches along the walls giving off blue-white light, the old queen on her throne in a shimmering green gown. Seated on chairs about her were selected Shillitoes and the travelers, who sat together, Tally and Deliani among them. The meeting's purpose was to discuss the quest and Runagar's proposed participation. Spekeren was reminded of a meeting like it before they left home. Hutt's parents had agreed that he join the quest. He was eager to go, thought Spekeren, but as keen as this young Shillito seems to be? It was the 11th day since Tally's awakening and Deliani's reappearance. Deliani was back to normal, but Tally wasn't. She was still troubled about losing Jilin, and, an accomplished flyer before her accident, she had lost confidence in her ability to fly, and was working every day with Deliani to restore it. Also present was Luce, Chief Curlay's practitioner for the neighboring Shilaran tribe. He had come to escort his tribe's bird and help show Runagar how to fly.
"Luce and Deliani have told me," said Spekeren, "that Runagar's made extraordinary progress with the recently borrowed bird."
Spekeren thought about this new Eilon. Deliani says it's called a crane. What an unusual creature, huge compared to our ravens, themselves among the largest birds in the home forest. Chuckling, he thought about her habits, her head, and how she slept. 9 days earlier, he and three Shillito elders had approached the Shilarans. He described the traveler's mission and asked to borrow one of the tribe's esteemed birds. The Shilaran Council considered the request carefully, but refused. Queen Lanara then traveled from her cave for the first time in years, and in the Shilaran's council chamber made the case that Runagar would be vital to the mission.
"Her arguments, or presence," thought Spekeren, "carried more weight than mine."
The council agreed, and Glenavar, their most prized Eilon, was dispatched to join the quest.
"They have only a few birds," thought Spekeren, "great and awkward as they are. What a sacrifice to let one go, and how much it is appreciated."
Lanara now spoke to Spekeren from her throne.
"The Shilarans understood why you undertook your mission. They were simply reluctant to loan an Eilon. Many a clan knows of the new horror in our world, some being visited by it, as were your community and ours. It has become too evident to ignore, though many of us did, having no idea what to do about it."
"My sentiments exactly," thought Spekeren, reminded of countless debates he had with his old friend Duan.
"I wonder how he's doing. Rogalanon and Rogustan, how far away they seem. But they'll be even farther when we resume our trek.
He remembered something he had said at a gathering before they left. It might prove more perilous to stay home than go on the mission.
Was I right?
Suddenly he felt compassion for those at home and wanted to be among them, to greet them and find out how they were. But the only way he could do so was to concentrate his efforts here and carry on the expedition, and he forced his thoughts back to the business at hand. The Queen was asking Deliani a question.
When will young Tally be ready to go?
Glancing at Tally, Deliani stood up.
I don't know. She was so close to death's door, we must do nothing to hurry her.
Deliani had been strangely silent throughout the meeting, and the old Queen noticed it. Like Speckerin's, Deliani's thoughts were not entirely on matters at hand. After answering Lenara's question, she didn't stop. Several days earlier, Deliani had asked for an audience with the Queen. They met alone, and Deliani tried to get information about what was troubling her, telling of her misadventure, being saved by Griglas, and meeting Silarud. When she asked questions about the Griglas situation, however, Lenara ignored them, gave no answers at all, and asked her to leave. This evening she was determined to try again. In the company of others and a formal session, the old queen might be forced, out of embarrassment or pressure, to answer. Deliani had nothing to lose.
She's not my queen, she told herself.
Glancing at the others in the meeting, she went on. You all know I was lost with my brave raven in the tunnels around this cave. What you don't know is how I got back. You will find it most interesting, the old queen interrupted.
I have considered your questions thoroughly and will answer them, but privately, not here.
Speckerin raised his eyebrows.
What's this all about?
After her previous experience, Deliani wasn't satisfied.
I might get the same treatment, she thought, the next time we're alone.
Nonetheless, she sat down to bide her time and wait for the right moment. Talk returned to the mission and Runagar's unusual island. Because of her great size, the bird was being kept outside. Getting to his feet, Issar addressed Speckerin in his piercing voice.
When I led you into the cave, I underestimated the size of your ravens. The tunnel we took is the most direct route to the cave, and I thought they'd make it through easily. I had no idea how much trouble you were having and wondered why you took so long. Runagar led the foxes through a larger passageway, but even that's not large enough for the bird outside. Now, let me display my prejudices and then sit down. Kirins, including Shillitoes, should stay away from birds. We're not meant to fly. It only leads to trouble.
He sat down abruptly. This was too much for Deliani, who was about to respond when Runagar chimed in.
I made the same mistake about the tunnel when Hutt and I left. But I strongly disagree about birds. Some of us were meant to fly, were born to fly.
Standing up, Deliani looked at Runagar.
Indeed, you were, but you aren't alone. Others in this tribe were born to fly.
She eyed Issar.
In fact, I believe all Shillitoes were.
Disbelief was on each listener's face but Lenara's. She gazed silently at the floor. Warming to the task, Deliani took her time, choosing words carefully, having discussed this only with the queen.
I was lost in the tunnels, completely lost except when I could see the cave through a hole near the waterfall. I didn't find my way out alone. That might have been impossible.
How did you get back?
Asked Hutt. Deliani stared at the queen, who had not looked up.
I was delivered from my prison, from the tunnel's perpetual midnight, by members of—
Enough!
Cried the queen, glaring at Deliani, her reedy voice as sharp as anyone had heard it.
You'll say nothing further!
She's not my queen,
Deliani reassured herself. She glanced at Runagar, whose gentle, dark green eyes conveyed strength to her, and continued.
By members of a race who lived in the cave long before you.
She gestured toward the vast, illuminated space they knew so well.
They occupied this space for hundreds of years, perhaps thousands, but were displaced by a tribe named Shillito.
Looks of wonder were on all faces but Lenara's. She drooped even further than was natural for her ancient body.
It is out, thought the queen. Finally out.
Then she noted a queer sensation deep in her heart, among all the other feelings about this. Something new. Relief.
Perhaps it's good, she thought, that it's out in the open.
It has taken a foreign Kirin, this woman from afar, to expose the unholy arrangement we have lived with these many, many years.
To everyone's amazement, except Lenara's, Deliani told of Grigla's past and present, of them rescuing and escorting her to what is now known as the Shillito Cave. She described Silarud and the unfinished business of this underground race.
It has been an uneasy truce, she said. For a long time, Grigla's and Shillito's have coexisted without overt conflict. But it wasn't always that way.
Kirin's The Spell of Noan, written and narrated by James D. Priest.
To learn more about Kirin's, visit www.kirinbooks.com.
You have been listening to A Good Book on Sun Sounds of Arizona.